Hello again, everybody, and welcome to a new edition of Canesport.com's Reflections as we take a walk down memory lane with some former Cane greats. And today's episode, we're going to be visiting with Stephen Maguire, a running back that many of you will remember from the late 1980s and early 1990s when he was the workhorse in Dennis Erickson's revolutionary one back that everybody seems to run these days, want to run these days, rather. So we'll talk a little bit more about that as we get going. I'm Gary Furman, the publisher of Canesport.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Bruce Warner, and, of course, Stephen Maguire. And, guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Gary.
Yeah, thanks, Gary.
We're going to go back and talk about your playing days in a minute, but you've got some very topical subject matter that we should definitely address first. And you're living up there in Hempstead, New York, up in Long Island, and somehow, some way, in the past few weeks, you picked up the coronavirus and have been
yes.
dealing with that recently. And obviously, it's a big deal up in New York. I was reading this morning, actually, that there's more people in New York that have coronavirus than any country in the world, which is just absolutely amazing. So tell us a little bit about, you know, what this has been like for you and when you how you think you might have gotten it and what it felt like when you realized you had it and what the recent days have been like for you.
Okay. Well, on March 23rd, I think that was a Monday or Monday night. I went to, no, 24th, I'm sorry. It was a Tuesday. I came home from work. I was feeling fine. Next thing you know, I started coughing and sneezing all late during the night. So my wife, she got out. She hauled ass out the room because, you know, of me coughing and sneezing. And the following day, I went down to a first responder down in Jones Beach, and I got tested. And then 2 days later, found out I was positive. And ever since then, you know, like maybe 5 days ago, I was locked up inside my bedroom, isolated, just eating chicken noodle soup and ginger tea, and, you know, and dealing with the backaches, headaches, and, you know, just feeling fatigued probably 15 hours of the day, just being real tired. But, you know, I was lucky enough that, you know, my breathing was pretty good when I called my doctor, and I told him about my first thing he asked me was how was my breathing situation, and I told him I was breathing fine. I didn't have no chest palpitation, you know, no tightness in my chest or nothing like that. So he just told me to treat it just like a normal flu. Just keep doing what you're doing, and now I'm pretty much healthy.
Yeah.
So how do you think
he
got it to
his wife?
Huh?
Oh, wow. You gave it to your wife,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, I think he might be the first person in the world with the Ramonavirus, not the coronavirus. Wife. So Ramona has it now. So if she wasn't with you gave it to her, didn't you, buddy?
She's good now.
She's good now, too?
Yeah. The first night I was coughing, she hauled ass out the bedroom. You know, then she left me. So,
so how do you think you got it?
It was either probably on the train. Who knows, you know, the train, either at work, you know, because back, you know, they were telling you back then not to wear a mask. Now they're telling you to wear a mask, you know. So, you know, I was riding the Long Island Railroad train. There was no social distancing nowhere, you know. So who knows, you know. And then that night when I got it, I got an email or a Facebook text saying that, you know, one of my friends, a coworker, died. And I was like, man, you know, that's when I really started getting scared. You know, because he was the same age as me. He played basketball for St. John's University at the time.
Wow.
Lee Green. Yeah. Good dude.
And he died of coronavirus?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
My goodness.
Young dude. Yeah.
And so you had heard about that before you felt sick?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that made you scared. So normally, if you were feeling the same way and this whole coronavirus thing hadn't come up, would you have thought – that maybe you just had a bad cold or something, or
only thing that's different is the aches, you know, the body mm-hmm. aches and the headaches, you know, but, you know, besides that, it's just like the normal flu to me, you know. And you know, guys was calling me up: Warren Sapp, Ryan Collins, Coleman Bell, Ryan McNeil, Alonzo Highsmith. They were all calling me up, you know, telling me to hang in there. Sapp called me almost every other day, just to make sure I was doing the right thing, eating my soup, drinking my tea, almost, you know, 10 hours out of the day.
And Stephen told me, and Gary, Stephen told me that he didn't go to a hospital, so he's home. So he had no access to oxygen or anything like that, like other coronavirus patients have, right, Steve?
Yeah. I just stayed at home because the hospitals here, they're in pretty bad situations. You know, most of the time, you know, people go to hospitals here, and the coronavirus is I know, like in East Elmhurst, it's a real bad situation with that virus going on inside that hospital, you know. So, you know, I decided just to stay home and isolate myself, and thank God I got better, you know.
So at what point do you decide I better call the doctor?
I think it was the second day, you know, you know, with the body aches, and then my job just told me to call my doctor just to get, you know, to make sure that everything's okay. So when I called him, and, you know, he just said, feel what I said earlier, just keep doing what you're doing, you know. As far as no tightness in your chest, you're good to go. So I was lucky, you know, for being healthy. But, you know, I've seen healthy people get real sick too. You know, so
are you waiting around for them to tell you, or if you tell them you're better, can you go back to work, or you have to sit around and wait for this whole thing to clear up?
Well, today my job just called me, so I'm going to figure out something. And that it's been 14 days, so I'm probably not going back to work. But I think I got to get tested again to make sure I'm not, you know, positive. You know, so
you need two negatives, I think.
Huh?
You need two negatives. You need to show two negatives before you can really get back out there. And obviously, you're going to wear gloves and a mask, I'm assuming.
Definitely, yeah, always, yeah.
So you call the doctor, and he tells you better go get tested. And what was the testing experience? Tell us about the testing experience.
Well, you drive up to the test site over there in Jones Beach, and, you know, I was a first responder, so I didn't need a appointment, so they let me go through, and I showed them my ID and everything, give them my address, and they stick a little plastic thing up your nose, and it makes you cough, and it's weird, and you know, it goes all the way back up to your nostrils, and that's pretty much it. And then 2 days later, you go online and you put up the test results, and it came back positive.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And no medicine or anything. Your doctor just said stay home and quarantine.
No, well, I'll just take a Tylenol. That was it. Just for the fever.
Oh, so it's been what? I guess about two weeks now. You've been just sitting in your bedroom over there.
Yep, 2 weeks eating soup and ginger tea. Lost a lot of weight, but I think I'm trying to gain it back now. You know, but.
So tell us what that was like.
You're going to start coughing.
Yeah.
Don't laugh, man, because I spoke to you before you started coughing, so we don't need you coughing.
I'm good.
So tell us what that was like, just sitting in the bedroom, all day. What was that like?
It was pretty much torture, man. You know, you can't leave the room. They dropping the food at the door, knocking on the door, and, you know, you got to pick the food up and close the door real quick. It was torture just sitting inside of, you know, sitting aside for 14, 15 days, being isolated, just watching the same old crappy TVs, no sports on, going crazy, you know. Oh.
But somewhere along the way you gave it to your wife, huh?
Yeah.
Tell us how you think that happened.
I think she got it the first night when I was coughing and sneezing all over the place.
Oh, man.
And then she got it, and she went upstairs and isolated herself upstairs in her room. So my daughter started taking care of both of us. And surprisingly, she didn't get it, you know, which is just weird, you know. She's 20 years old, and just she didn't get it. You know, she was taking care of both of us inside the house. So
that's good.
Yeah.
But you were in separate areas of the house, huh? You've been in separate areas of the house the last 2 weeks?
Separate areas, yep. She was upstairs, and I was downstairs.
Based on what I've been hearing from some of the guys on the message boards that we have at canesport.com who've been reflecting on their experiences, I mean, I think there's a lot of married couples up there that after being in quarantine now for 3-4 weeks wouldn't object too much to that, but, you know, some obviously not. But man, that must have been bizarre. You're on one side of the house, your wife's on the other. Did you talk to each other at all? What did you do, call each other on the phone?
Only through the door and FaceTime video. Yeah, pretty much. That was weird. We were just FaceTime ourselves at night saying goodnight, you know, and stuff like that. And, you know, get better and I love you. You know, it was weird.
Yeah, and your son is down here, so he's okay, right?
Yeah, he's good.
Right. He's I talked to him.
Yeah.
So you're both starting to feel better?
Yes, much better, man, much better. We ventured out to the store a couple of days ago just to get some fresh air and you know, just to get out the house. And, you know, we had our mask on and our gloves on and, you know, just to get out the house just to get some fresh air.
Well, that's good to hear.
Can you imagine Caesar walking around with a mask in Newark? You'd probably get arrested.
All right, let's go take a walk. Let's go take a walk down memory lane now, Stephen, for a few. And, know, I remember how you became a Hurricane, and I guess it was Jimmy Johnson was recruiting Vinny Testaverde at the time. And I believe he was up there in New York for – I think it was Newsday was the newspaper back then that did a Player of the Year banquet or something. And he was up there. They were honoring Vinny for winning the 1986 Heisman was what it was. And he met you there. You were, I guess you were getting an award at that banquet or something along those lines. And he met you there at the banquet and he offered you a scholarship, sight unseen, like without ever having watched you play football. Tell us that story.
Yes. Story was, I tell people that story all the time and they look at me like I'm crazy, but I told them that's how Coach Johnson was. You know, that I went there. I met Bo Jackson. I met you know, Vinny Testaverde, Archie Griffin. You know, I met them. So I go to meet Coach Johnson. He's like, oh, you know, I was supposed to send a coach up there to come talk to you. And you know, I think it was storming or whatever, and Coach never got a chance. So then, you know, we was talking, and he told me about Fork Union Military Academy. It's the same school Testaverde went to. He said, yeah, you go here for a year, and you come to the University of Miami, and you still have 4 more years left. So that was a better option than going to junior college, I thought, you know. So that's what I did. But not knowing, you know, that he's a man of his word, I got my SAT scores up. I called him up personally, and he took the phone call. Which I was shocked because the man just won the national championship. And he had a flight for me. He said, I'm going to get you on the next flight out of there and you could come down and visit. I called my coach up. He was kind of upset because he wanted to be involved, but I did it all on my own. And he got me on the next flight down to Miami. I visited and after that, I signed my scholarship. I was supposed to stay down there originally, but things didn't work out during that semester, so I had to come back home and get a job and then start working out. And then in August, that's when I came down here.
But quite a story.
That's how that story went down, you know. He could have told me no, you know. There was no promissory note. There was no hands, you know. It was a handshake, but, you know, the man probably shakes hands thousands of times at that time, you know. And
I'm sure he must have seen film on you in between all that period of time before you got down there. He must have seen you.
I don't think my coach – no. Well, no. My coach never sent the film. No.
He never watched
the
film. Yeah.
Never watched the film.
I mean, it obviously was a pretty darn good decision by Jimmy because you came down here, a man on a mission, and when you graduated, you were the second all-time leading rusher in school history with 1,953 yards. But you were just an absolute terror
in the rest of the
Yeah, I know. I mean, you were lethal in the red zone. I mean, you still hold the school record for career rushing touchdowns with 35. Unfortunately, your rushing record, because Jimmy and these guys kept recruiting after you left. And you had guys like Edgerrin James and James Jackson and Clinton Portis, Willis McGahee, Frank Gore. They started recruiting a little bit better. So you're presently number 13 on the career rushing list after once being number two.
I'll take that.
But nobody scored more touchdowns than you, Steve, not even close. And so you might have that sometime. Obviously, a lot to be proud of from your playing career. So let's go there. And Bruce and I obviously had the great pleasure of watching every single one of your games and know about all the great things that you did. When you look back on your Hurricane career, what's your fondest memory?
Being with the guys, the camaraderie, just being in the locker room, hanging out, not having the bills to worry about. back then, Bruce, we hungry. Come to Bruce's house, we eat.
But you couldn't say it back then.
We go to Bruce's house and enjoy ourselves. Life was so much easier back then, man. I tell you, man. With me and Lamar and Colin Harris were just talking, I was the only running back that lasted out of that whole recruiting class that graduated, that came in with me. I'm going to tell you, T.K. Dorsey, Ellery Roberts, Terrell Jackson, and Kevin Gibbs, who passed away, and me. I was the only one that lasted. Everybody else transferred. Kevin Gibbs passed away. Terrell went to Florida. Ellery went to Stanford. I don't know where T.K. Dorsey went. I think he went to Rutgers. But out of that whole class, so that just goes to show you that all that recruiting, ESPN top 150 and all that other stuff, doesn't mean too much. It all comes from the heart, Find me the players that want to go to the University of Miami and play.
You were the epitome of playing with heart, that's for sure.
Yeah,
those games against Florida State were really epic. And as Gary knows, he was there, I was there, and everybody in the stadium knew you were going to get the ball, and they still couldn't stop you. That was the strength. I mean, you guys, you had a good passing offense, but on all those short yardage downs, everybody knew you were going to get the ball, and it didn't matter. And you told a story when you were doing the show, and you could tell it again about what happened during practice when you were playing against our defensive line, and you really couldn't get anywhere. How much easier it was. So tell everybody what that was about, because people don't understand. How the hell could you get the ball, and they all know you're getting it, and they still couldn't stop you?
Oh, my freshman year, I tell you, it was listen to the defensive line. It was Shane Curry, Willis Pegues, Jimmy Jones, Cortez Kennedy, Russell Maryland, Bill Hawkins, and I'm trying to think. Did I miss anybody? And then you had the linebackers. You had Bernard Clark, Roy Carter. Then you had Bobby Harden, Bubba McDowell in the secondary. So me getting 2 yards against that defensive line, and when all we used to do, I swear, was do short yardage and goal line offense against the number one defense in the country at that time. So every Tuesday and Wednesday was full go, and guys used to step to the back of the line. You can see Ellery Roberts, T.K. Dorsey, all those guys. They stopped stepping to the back because it was full go. Coach Davis used to promise them, if these guys score a touchdown, y'all guys are going to run. So what you think, Cortez and Russell Maryland, and those big guys, they ain't want to run, so they will turn it up against Mario Cristobal, Diego London, those guys are freshmen trying to block. You got two first-round defensive linemen out there. So just imagine how tough that was, But it was crazy.
But you stepped to the front of the line, huh?
Yeah, I had to. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I had crazy Coach Ogeron and Coach Davis screaming at me. So no matter what, they're like, McGuire, get in there and run the ball. And you know what? I actually took pride on being the star running back. They said, like, you're going to wear number five, whoever the star running back for that team was that time. You know, I took pride in that, you know, because now, you know, the coaches are looking at me saying that, you know, this guy's actually doing what he's supposed to do on scout team. So, you know, I took pride in that, and I just went to work.
See, well, they rewarded you. Things... Go ahead,
guys. Yeah, I was going to say they rewarded them. I mean, you got 106 carries in your first season, 519
yeah.
yards, 4.9 yards an attempt. You put up a 136-yard game against East Carolina. And then the greatest thing
mm-hmm.
of all, Stephen, is after the Canes dismantled Notre Dame, 27-10. Notre Dame was number one in the country at that time. They put you on the cover of Sports Illustrated. And, man, what the heck? I can't even begin to imagine what that was like as a young kid just getting going in college football, and you're on the cover of SI, which was a big deal back then. Talk about that.
Oh, that was big. Well, I'll never forget I went to practice. All I heard was Cortez saying, SI, SI. I was like, what the hell is he talking about? You know, because I ain't pay attention. You know, I was, you know, after the game, you know, the cover comes out. And back then, we didn't get Sports Illustrated, but obviously somebody mailed it in. So Cortez kept saying, SI, SI, SI dog, SI dog. I'm like, what the hell is Cortez talking about? Then that somebody showed me the picture. I was like, oh, man. And then, you know what, still to this day, I still get the cover of Sports Illustrated sent to my house. I don't know how they found my address, but they sent it here. I signed it, and, you know, God bless. And if that's make somebody happy, and then that's it, you know.
That's pretty cool. That's a pretty cool story. Yeah, and what Gary and I had talked about during the season, this past season, probably the last couple of seasons doing the Kane Sport Live show, is playing the ones against the ones. Now, if you would have been playing against the two defense at the time, I don't know if you would have had any confidence to go out there and do these things that you did against, like, the likes of Florida State. But when you play against the ones, and that's what we keep talking about, and it's like, I think it should be mandatory, but I don't see that coming from these coaches nowadays.
Yeah, it's totally different now. I went to watch them practice. I guess with all the concussion stuff, there's only a certain amount of time that they can hit and wrap up and all this other nonsense. But, you know, like you said, we always played against the ones, you know, ones against the ones. And that's how we're going to get better, you know, going against Jesse Armstead, Darren Smith, Michael Barrow. You know, those guys are, you know, top linebackers, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, going against those guys and going against the Mark Caesars on defense, trying to rip your head off, you know. That was Hurricane football back then, just battling against the ones and the ones.
Yeah. Well, I used to go down to watch the practices and the scrimmages, and you guys could hardly move the ball. I remember watching it, and I remember saying to my friends, you know, and we would say, they're going to get killed. And you went up and scored 51 points against Wisconsin because that's just the way it was. Your defense was so dominant. But it didn't affect your confidence at all. You destroyed Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's what I got. Yep, I never forget that.
Right.
It often didn't
all right, so,
good, but hey.
So year two, you're
mm-hmm.
it's the fourth game of the season. Florida State comes to town. They actually were number two in the country at the time. We were number nine. You got 80,000 plus fans in the stands in the Orange Bowl. And that's Stephen. I remember this, when the stakes were the highest, that's when Stephen McGuire was at his best. And you put up, I think it was about 176 yards on 31 carries in that game. Dennis made you the workhorse of the offense. He said, we're going to beat these guys to a pulp. And just kept pounding the rock and pounding the rock. And the amazing thing I remember about that game is, you know, Dennis was made his reputation as a passing game guy. Like, you know, he was, you know, we realize it now as we watch everybody run the spread, but Dennis was way ahead of his time. Like, he was really running the spread, you know, back then. And he was known as a passing game guy. And he comes into this big game. I mean, it was huge in Florida State and the full stadium. And he just kept pounding the ball with you. And you just killed him, 176 yards. What do you remember from that day?
Oh, you know what my motivation for that game was? I remember the year before, Bernard Clark. Dexter Carter put a flag on top of his head and made the cover of Sports Illustrated. And I remember those guys dancing over there on the sideline. That year we lost, Regina went up there, and I was only lost. And we lost that game. I'll never forget that. I hated them because they were dancing on the sideline. They put the flag on top of Tiger head. And I said to myself, I said, I'm never going to lose to these guys again. So the next year, Coach Erickson gave me the ball. Like you said, I ended up with 31 carries, 176 yards. You know, I think at halftime I had like 80 or 90 yards already at halftime, which is unheard of against that number one. I think I had like the number two defense in the country at that time. That's what you did. But, you know, that's what motivated me, though. People don't realize that. You know, I hated them. I hated them with a passion.
Well, you did it again the next
What was the final score of that game?
It was like 31.
31 nothing?
No.
It was
88. It was like 31-24, something like that. And I think they scored a late touchdown.
The 31-22 is the game I'm talking about. Yeah, 31-22.
Like, yeah.
But then you did it again the next year. We go to Florida State.
Oh.
They're number one in the country. We're number two in the country. It was the wide right game. Where they missed the field, but you scored the winning touchdown in that game. You put 142 yards on them again. You know, this time 142, and then they end up missing the field goal that would have won the game, and the Canes went to number one in the country after that one, and actually went on to win the national
championship. Yep.
But you know, Stephen, I mean. The thing I also remember, and it really, I'm sure that this just absolutely still grains on you all these many years later. I think it was the next game against Boston College. You got hurt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that sucked. Yeah, like my roommate Mark just said, I was running through them like hot butter through your teeth, you know. But then, you know, this is that I got hurt, you know. I had like 60 or 70 yards, I think, in the first quarter or something like that, and I was killing them, man. And Leon searching to this day, he said, man, why didn't you just run out of bounds? You was right there. Why are you trying to make the cutback? So, you know, but, you know, things happen in life. You know, I'm good. You know, I got my health, you know, and you know, my family. I got another 2 more years till I retire. And, you know, all is good.
Yeah, that was a tough week, Stephen, because we had talked. Yeah. Stephen and I have gone to dinner, and we talked about him maybe leaving after his junior year. And then that happened. So it was ironic. It was terrible. It was kind of like Bratton, you know, and McGahee.
Yep.
It was the same thing.
Yep.
And it never came back for you. You know, I mean, you played as a senior, but it never really repaired for you, did it?
Nah, never did. You know, I think, you know, I had three major knee ligaments, you know, it was somewhat, almost a little bit. I know Rusty's was like four ligaments he tore in his leg. So mine was like three, you know. So, you know, it was just one of those things that things happen in life and, you know, you go on and, you know, and enjoy the times and memories that I have with Bruce and the guys on the team. And that's it, you know.
But you came back the following year and it was Wide Right 2, and that was. And that was a fun week because that was the week that I brought Chris Fowler over to meet with you and Caesar and Hambone and Kelvin. And to this day, Chris Fowler says that's the greatest interview he ever had that nobody will ever see. It's even in the Sports Illustrated article that they did on Chris Fowler. He said that. Remember that, Steve?
Yeah, I remember.
And he was all about Florida State kicking your ass. And by the end of the night, we spent 3 hours up there in Steve's apartment. By the end of the night, the next day, he went on that show, pregame show, and he picked Miami because he was convinced that they were not afraid of these guys. Right, Steve?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And good they won. That was wide right, too.
Well, yep, exactly, yep.
So Steve,
that was a great memory. And then you know, then they wound up playing Texas in the Cotton Bowl, and that was a wild game, too. I mean, that was a great way to finish a career. Steven coming out before the game, he was taunting. If you see the videos, Gary, he was right there in the middle of the field, quiet Steven, just pointing fingers at Texas. Come on, come on, let's get it on. And they got it on that day.
Yeah, we did. Texas sucks, man. That's why. Guys are pissed off.
So you have this wonderful college career, all these great memories, and you didn't get the chance to play in the National Football League. What was that like to have, you know, at first reconciling that?
You know, it kind of sucked, you know, because you know if I didn't get hurt, who knows what you know that I would have been successful, maybe I would have been a bust, who knows, you know what I'm saying? But you know, life goes on, and I'm not one to cry for spilt milk. You just gotta, you know, pull your boots up and just keep going on, and you know, enjoying life, and enjoy the good times that you have, you know, as a Hurricane.
Well, you had that experience last May 2nd when Steven got put into the UM Sports Hall of Fame. That was
definitely a
great honor for him too. And fortunately, he invited me as a guest and Caesar as a guest, and that was a great night, wasn't it, Steve?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that was an excellent night, man. I was hoping to go back this year. I mean, I was ready to go back, but everything got canceled. So you know, I don't know when they're going to do it again. Coming up, you know, I was looking forward to coming down there again. Yeah.
All right. So
like you said, Bruce. Go ahead.
So football's over at that point in your life, and you decide. You ended up becoming a police officer in New York City. And tell us about how you ended up going in that direction and the process that was involved in getting into the police force.
Well, my mother, she told me to come down and take the test. I was like, Mom, I don't want to come down there and be, you know, a cop in New York City, you know. She said, I'll just come down and take the test. You know, you ain't doing nothing. So, you know, I was teaching at the time in Broward County. So my mother said, come down here and take the test. So I go down there and take the test. I pass and, you know, and go through the academy. And, you know, and they say, they say they got a football team. I said, all right, you know, let me try for the football team, you know, and go home your homes. Somebody saw an article on me, you know, I guess they remember me from college football. And, you know, they got me on the team, and I started playing, and, you know, it kind of took some of the years off, you know, as far as being the same monotony of just going through, you know, being a cop, you know, a bunch of great guys on NYPD football team. And, you know, we won, like, 3 national championships with the National Public Safety Football League at that time. And it was fun, you know, and it kept me in shape a little bit. And, you know, and I had a great time, you know. But being a cop, it was fun. It's stressful at times. Like now, you know, with all the stuff going on, you know, 9/11. When I came through, I was in the 9/11 class. You know, we did close to 9 months inside the academy at that time. And now, you know, I'm about to retire, going through this coronavirus. So, you know, this is New York City, you know, this is where everything happens. So, you know, I'm not mad. You know, I'm happy. I'm about to retire and hopefully come back down to the state of Florida and retire and live good, you know.
So what's it been like being a police officer in New York City? Probably might be the toughest job in the country, really, for police, you know, with all the things that go on in New York and the number of people and the different – just the different elements that you have to deal with, you know, from a wide range of perspectives and stuff in New York. Tell us about what that's been like.
It's been exciting. You know, it's a city that, like I say, it's a city that never sleeps. And if you could think of it, it's going to happen. You know, anything, you know, shootings, stabbings, domestic violence calls, you name it, you know, emotionally disturbed people. If you want to become a cop, here's the city to become a cop and learn to be, you know, to handle all types of situations. You know, cops out here, you know, they go out here to do their job, and, you know, I don't think no cop will come out. I don't think no cop in the United States wants to come out here and shoot anybody at that time. I remember all the cops were shooting a lot of African-Americans. You know, it was just things that happen in life, you know. But, you know, New York City, NYPD has been great to me. No issues. A lot of great guys. And, you know, my time is coming to an end, you know.
How many times have you had to use the gun?
Zero, right, Steve?
Never.
You've never had a shootable.
Never.
That's never. That's awesome. Have you ever been scared?
You know, yeah, oh, definitely. You know, I worked midnight for like 16 years, and, you know, there's always a couple of situations where you run into where people just started shooting, and you don't know where the bullet's coming from. You don't know who has the gun. And, you know, people just started running, and what do you do? You know, if somebody's shooting, aren't you going to run too? You know, so, you know, it's crazy, you know. Believe you me, there's stories behind stories of craziness of NYPD that goes on.
What's your most amazing one? What's your most amazing story?
Oh, I got to think about that one, man. Well, you know what? I just came out of the academy. I was like maybe 6 months out of the academy, and I was involved. I wasn't involved. I was like 2 minutes away from a cop got shot in the chest, you know, and he worked in my precinct, you know, and we were right there. And, you know, we handcuffed the guy, we went to court and everything. The guy's doing me, I think the guy's doing like 70 years now. But that was my first. I'll never forget that, you know. You know, man, the cop got shot right there in his chest. It was like a minute away. And we arrived on the scene. You know, we shut it down, handcuffed the guy. And you know, thank God that, you know, the cop lived.
You know, but you were mostly in Brooklyn, weren't you?
Yeah.
Mostly in Brooklyn, not in Manhattan. And recently in Manhattan. But mostly
money
in Brooklyn, which was no prize back then either.
Yeah, it's changing now. So, you know, where I work at now is totally changing. You got $5 million houses over there now, you know, but crime is still crime, you know.
So you're getting ready to retire?
Yes.
When's your retirement date?
Officially 7/11/2021.
Wow. And you're going to move to Florida like all the other New Yorkers, aren't you?
I might do one extra year. I don't know yet.
One extra year?
Yeah, I might. It all depends what's going on with this coronavirus crap.
That's true.
So what's retirement going to look like? Tell us, where are you going to live? Where do you think you're going to live? I assume it's going to be South Florida.
I don't know about South Florida, man. South Florida too hectic. I have to go up like maybe West Palm Beach or something like that. And,
oh, okay.
South Florida.
Well, you could still come down and eat at Sicilian Oven.
Oh.
You know,
definitely, yeah.
Bruce is always buying
right
at Sicilian
here.
Oven,
and
you can get a couple good meals in and watch the games and football.
I took him to Sicilian. He did go, right?
Yeah, I went there.
Come see the Canes and Hard Rock.
Yeah. Hey, that's what I'm looking forward to, you know, just to sit back and enjoy and relax, watch the Hurricanes play, and, you know, hopefully they'll get back to that dominant stage again, you know.
Well, they're going to an up-tempo spread, Stephen. What do you think of that? You're a football guy. What do you think of the up-tempo spread?
Well, they say the quarterback is pretty good at it. What's the dude named King?
Yeah, De'Aaron King.
Yeah. Very athletic. Yep.
He's very athletic, so that's what we need, you know. And we always got the talent as far as running backs and wide receivers. It's just the offensive line. That's going to be the key, you know. That's always the key, you know. Without them, you know, we ain't going anywhere, you know. And it's going to be tough, you know.
It's been, you know, 17 long years, man. It's been, you know, good thing for you. You've been up in New York working, because for those of us down here in South Florida, it's been a long 17
tough,
after all the years we got to watch guys like you out there and the great teams and the national titles. And, you know, Miami hasn't really been relevant for about 17 of them now. What's it been like? You talk to all these former players. What's it been like for you guys to just see the program kind of drift around like the way it's been?
It's frustrating, you know. I was talking to Lamar and Kelvin earlier this week, and it's frustrating because, you know, we talk about the talent, and these guys got talent. I don't know if it's in their heart, you know. I don't know what it is. I don't know how they practice. You know, it's, you know, are they just giving guys the position, the starting position, and instead of making these guys work for it, you know, who knows what's going on, you know? I mean, the talent is there. Miami always have talent, you know. You just got to get it out, and you got to get these guys going, you know.
What made – I mean, obviously, you guys always had – great players and things like that, but not everybody would have been a 4 or 5 star today. I mean, one of the things that I thought made Miami great through the years was just the little things, the intangibles, the work ethic. And another thing that I think really went unnoticed a lot was the level of coaching that you guys had. You know, everyone gets so distracted by the great players, and there were obviously a whole lineup of them, but there were some pretty good coaches that came through Miami as well.
Yes.
And it kind of just all came together, didn't it?
Yes. I mean, you had – I know when I got there my freshman year, I had Coach Davis, I had Coach Wonstadt, you know, I had Coach Overall, who was running the scout team at the time. And we had Coach Keith Armstrong. He's the, I think he's a special teams coach for the Atlanta Falcons, I think, or Tampa Bay right now. And then we had Coach Tupperville, you know. Who else? You know,
that last
Randy
staff.
Cannon,
that
Randy
last Jimmy Johnson staff was it was incredible. It absolutely was incredible.
Yeah, right.
Then they left. You know? They left, Stephen. They all left.
Yep.
Like what?
They all left.
What went through? Tell us what went through your mind at that point.
You know me. I fell in love with the school. I didn't fell in love with the coaches because, remember, I tell you, I wasn't heavily recruited, so I didn't know none of the coaches at that time. But when Coach Brodsky left, it kind of hurt a little, you know. I didn't know what I was getting involved in, you know, with Coach Alex Woods, but you know, he turned out to be a great. Great coach, you know. He's still coaching to this day, you know. His staff. He had Coach Harrison bringing his staff, Coach Barkowski, who else? Coach Calm, who passed away, Coach Dave Arnold, you know. Who else? Come on, Bruce. Does you know nobody else?
Yeah, his memory's long gone. it all kind of runs together. But you know, the one thing I just thought of that I would want to ask you is, obviously, you know, Dennis came in and things went great for the first 3 years, won 2 national titles.
Mm-hmm.
But then Dennis started to, you know, he lost it a little bit. And it, you started seeing that a steady little decline there the last couple of years, and then he finally went to the Seahawks. But as a guy that was in the guy that was in the program, did you see little things starting to slide a little bit, or was it kind of invisible to you guys?
It was kind of invisible. I mean, but then you know you start to see little things that you know as coaches. You know, I guess you know I came back to see some of the other guys at that time. Guys would get a little bit more complacent, you know, and, they wasn't finishing up and, you know, sprinting, going the way through, you know, being lackadaisical at practice, you know, and in the show. And, you know, when we lost our game against the Huskies at home, you know, that hurt, you know. You know,
it's hard to say on top,
also,
though.
After that Cotton Bowl win, they started, the NCAA started in with them with all the rule changes, and I guess you know, these guys maybe got a little too full of themselves.
Yeah,
I think that's what happened. They got a little too full of themselves. But the one thing that Gary was talking about a few minutes ago, this is the last thing I have, is that we knew back then when you guys lost, the following week's opponent was dead.
Yeah.
And we knew that if you played a bad game, the following opponent was in trouble, whether home or on the road, because you were part of that streak. But nowadays, I can't even tell you. I'm sure Gary could tell you the same thing. From one game to the next, I have no idea what's going to happen. One half to the next, one quarter to the next, one series to the next. They've been so inconsistent for these last 17 years, for the most part, that it's frustrating for the fans. To me, that's the worst of it all. You don't even know what Miami's going to do anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, how we go from losing to FIU, you figure that, okay, you lose at FIU, you come out, and you're going to go kick some ass against Louisiana Tech.
Or
right?
Duke.
Yeah, exactly.
Or Duke,
yeah,
which was the last game of the season, I think,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yeah. Duke, FIU, Louisiana Tech, who cares, you know? Those are the teams that shouldn't be on the field with us, you know? And we lose those games, you know?
Yeah, well, last year put me over the edge. I'm not gonna lie. It's just, you know, been watching it for 17 years, and I started to see this thing get in the way in the middle of the season last year, and I saw where it was going, and it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And man, you lose to FIU and Louisiana Tech at the end of the, I mean, that is just unforgivable. It's unforgivable. I mean, it's just unforgivable.
Yeah.
So they've made some moves. To Manny's credit, he, you know, it's as rough of a first year as you could ever expect to have, but he didn't go into denial about it. He didn't sit there and say, I've got this, everything I'm doing is right. He made staff changes that he needed to make. He brought in a couple really high quality transfers, and now they're going to go out this year and try to be better. The schedule is very favorable, Stephen, and I really think this can be a 9-win team this year. I really do, and I think if he gets to 9, I think Manny will get to go to year 3. So, you know, that's what they're obviously shooting for. I mean, I'm sure they're thinking 12-0, but I'm not sure that's reality.
Mm-hmm.
You're coming in from 6-7.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if you're going to make that kind of jump all in one, but the schedule is very, very, very soft. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But hopefully the days will get better for the Hurricanes, and you've beaten the coronavirus. You know, just like you beat out FSU all those years, you've knocked this damn virus out, it looks like, and they're going to be banging down your door soon to get you back to work so that the streets in New York are a safe place, and it's all good in the life of Stephen Maguire now. So, you know, thank you so, so much for spending this time with us today on Reflections, and we'll have you on at some point down the road on Kane Sport Live again.
Right.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on how things are going. And so for Bruce Warner, I'm Gary Furman. We thank Stephen Maguire once again, and we'll see you next time, everybody.